Good morning, gentlemen. I guess my function here today is to be timekeeper. And so first we'll identify a few housekeeping items. Number one, there are additional coat hangers now available. If at break somebody wants to hang up their coat. Our plan is to start about now, which is about 9:15, and have the first session till 10:15. We'll then break for coffee and start again around about 10:45 and go till about 11:45, at which time we'll break. And you have time to wash your hands, powder your nose, have a beer, whatever you wish, and then we'll have lunch at 12. Then we'll reconvene at 1:30 and with the objective of winding up about 5 o'clock this afternoon. It's certainly a pleasure for me to be here and to participate in your symposium. And I thought if I was going to be here, I better find out what a symposium is. And I see it's a technical symposium on generally communications. So I looked up in the dictionary what a symposium was. And I find that the early Greeks used to have symposium or symposia. And they were convivial meetings, usually followed by dinner and involving extensive drinking. As well as an exchange of ideas. However, there was another definition that is more common in today's age, and I thought it may be applied to today's. I didn't think that's what we had in mind. The other one indicated that it was a group of people where they got together to exchange ideas. And so this is, we want to make clear that the intent is not for the speakers to get up and talk to you. It's for everybody to get in and exchange ideas and ask questions, answer questions, and so on. We have at the front a tape recorder that we're going to record the proceedings. However, if somebody, we want to get into some rather nasty questions and rather nasty answers that people would rather not have on the record, then just I'd signify you'd like this off the record, because we don't want the idea of the tape recorder to make people afraid to say what they want to say. So if you have something you want to say off the record, just signify and George will take care of it. I also looked in the dictionary to see what communications was. And I know what communications means, and I'm sure you people all know, and I suspect there's some fair agreement on between us on what communications means. However, I have a friend who's in the advertising business, and he thinks he's in the communications business. I'm just a technical guy that looks after a few bits of things. He's really the communications guy, because he's putting together ideas and passing them out. I was talking to Joe Jordan, and he had another definition of communications that I thought was interesting. There was a fellow spent all his life in the outback in Australia, and as he got older, he decided what this world needed was better means of communication. So he said when he died, he was going to leave in his will some money to provide for improving communications. And then he passed away, and they read his will, and sure enough, he left $100,000 to be devoted to the selective breeding of pigeons. So I don't think that's the kind of communications we have in mind here today. But that was Joe's definition. Well, with that as a preamble and introduction, I would like to introduce Bob Eldridge, who will speak to us on communication trends and problems. Bob is the Special Services Development Supervisor for British Columbia Telephone. He spent 10 years in the Royal Air Force, mostly in the mobile radio telephone end, and he's been doing that ever since. He's quite active on several CRTPB committees. He's chairman of Study Group 8, CCIR, Mobile Services, and he represents Canada at the international meetings of CCIR. He's chairman of the Western Canada Telecommunications Council, and he's an active ham, and I see his call letters are VE7BS. So, with that as an introduction, I'd like to introduce Bob Eldridge.
Uh, They saw me coming. They kept the call until I got to Canada. Incidentally, I didn't know the business of definitions was going to crop up, but I came across an interesting definition of communications the other day. You know, most people argue about whether communications exist if no response has been received. You know, there are many people in the academic field that say communications is not an outgoing thing, it has to be a two-way thing, and if it's not two-way, it's not communications. And many people argue against this. And I came across something the other day which seems to me to be a perfect summation of the thing. It said that communications has occurred if a change of state has occurred in the receiver. In other words, it doesn't matter whether the receiving party acknowledged it or thought he understood it or what. If he got anything from it at all, in other words, if there was cognition within his brain or the sensing device or what have you, the communications has occurred. And I think that sums up the whole business. It's not really a two-way thing, it's a one-way thing with results, hopefully. Sometimes the wrong results. Sometimes the message is received, it's a totally different message to the one the guy meant to send. Would you remind me 10 minutes before I get to the end of my time? Because I lose complete track of time. Most of my friends know and all my enemies know. Gentlemen, if what I would prefer is as much as possible from the floor. You know, I get a little annoyed at the normal kind of meeting where someone gets up in front and talks for 22 minutes and then the chairman says, well, I'm afraid we haven't got time for discussion, we have to go on to the next one, and the same happens after the next paper. And I don't like this. I don't like the idea of someone in front talking to a room full of people who know as much as or more about the subject than he does, and they have to sit there like a lot of stuffed dummies and take it all and not be allowed to argue. Now, I'm quite honest when I say that I want you to say anything that you want to say, and not just ask questions. If you want to make a statement, instead of asking questions, if you want to make an observation, if you want to argue with something which another speaker said, then this is fine by me. And although I have a sort of agenda for myself, it doesn't matter a damn to me whether I get to the end of my list or not. If I get to halfway through the things I intended to talk about, and there is something there which everybody is interested in, and we carry on with that and we get to the end of the session, well, that's fine by me, because it seems nonsense to try to gallop through an agenda for myself when I object to galloping through agendas for meetings. Now, incidentally, if you want to stop me, then please stop me. Don't be shy of putting me off or something, or putting me off my stroke. If you feel that I'm going on to the next thing and something ought to be ventilated about the thing that I've just spoken about, then stand up, wave your arms in the air, shout, or anything to stop me so that we can deal with that thing right then, rather than make a note of it and try and remember to fit it in at some time in the future. Now, my present job, I've been working for about a year or so in a non-engineering job. For the previous 10 years, I was in charge of a small dedicated group in engineering of our company, which had all the company's staff skills in mobile radio. We looked after paging and mobile radio and anything which is not normal toll telephone. And we had the planning people and the rates people and the engineering people all sitting in that one little group. And a year ago, we broke that group up and distributed it amongst the various departments, and I moved away from it altogether, and nobody replaced me. I don't know, I consider they retired my jersey. They couldn't find anybody that could replace me, but my opponents say that the job wasn't necessary for that 10 years anyway, and at last they managed to move me. So now I am in a corporate development department where I am wholly concerned with the future. And I find it's a totally new field. And when I first went into it, I was quite enthusiastic about the predictions about the future and enthusiastic about participating in predicting the future. And the longer I am in the job, the more I come to the conclusion that you cannot predict the future and that there isn't much point. And that the thing for a planner to try to do is to plot the direction of a road, of an infinitely long road, and set off in the right direction along that road and leave the corporation free to turn to the left or turn to the right as circumstances dictate at some time in the future. Not say by 1985 we intend to be at that place on the road, because you just cannot predict what catastrophic change will happen in social needs or political revolution or some bright studier of hard of hearing inventing things like telephones and things like that. You know, most inventions come up out of the blue, most catastrophic inventions come up out of the blue, and they cannot be predicted. And what I found is that it's rather rash to prophesy, because looking back at the last 10 or 15 years of prophecies, you find that 10 years ago, things were predicted for today, which just aren't here. And many things were not even mentioned 10 years ago, which are now here in full flood. And yet the prophets of those days were quite well equipped and quite intelligent, as the prophets of today are. There is only one thing which strikes me, and that is that if somebody is spending a lot of R&D money on something today, then it is probable that this thing will be in operation tomorrow. He will see that it's in operation tomorrow. Because once the big R&D money has been committed, somebody is sure that either the market exists or the market can be created. But when it comes to something that people are talking about today, many of the marvelous things which are talked about today, not only in mobile radio telephone, but in all the multifarious things which are supposed to be going to appear in the home in the next decade, the cashless society, call up of advertisements from the local store by the housewife on the cable television system or the telephone system or what. Many of these things are not actually being fully R&D'd today. They are only being projected. And it seems to me that Dr. Chisholm of BNR is on the ball when he says that social change is what really dictates the pace of progress. Not the state of the art, not technological possibilities, but what people actually need. And if they really need it, then the need will be impressed upon the technological people, and the technological people will get with it and invent something to fill the need. And the main course of change is normally evolutionary, not revolutionary. It's only the exception which turns things upside down and comes up with something totally new. Most things which occur are extensions from what occurred before. And this is another pattern which we've observed in looking at the business of prediction and the fulfillment of prediction. There are two kinds of predictions. Predictions of more of what we have now, how much more there will be. And these predictions are usually conservative. When someone says that today we're handling X million and in 5 years' time it will be Y million, their estimate of Y million is usually low. But when somebody says we will be doing something totally different in 5 or 10 years' time, they are usually wrong. They usually miss the boat altogether because they were not capable of foreseeing the secondary thing which was going to bring across this prime change. Now, if we cannot see exactly what the next step is, then how can we predict the step after next? We best confine ourselves to trying to look at the thing which is known to be in the near future and not waste time thinking about what will come after that thing until we've had a good glimpse of that thing. So I want to talk primarily about the near future, and I don't want to talk about vehicular radio telephone. I want to talk about radio telephone, because the first point I want to make is that we concentrate at the moment on the vehicle as being the modus operandi, the supporting platform for radio telephone. and this is about to change. Could you put the first slide on now? You've switched off the view graph, please, Ray. Why is the present radio telephone in the vehicle? Now, the main reason it's there is because up to now, the thing has been so heavy, so large, and the batteries in particular are so large and so heavy that there hasn't been much alternative. And the vehicle also is a very convenient place to mount an antenna. And with the state of antennas development, the way we've had it for the last 20 years or so, it's usually very useful to have the ground plane of the vehicle roof or trunk or what have you to get a reasonable horizontal radiation pattern from the antenna. Now, it seems to me and to most people in the field, I think you will agree, that the trend is already there for the radio to leave the vehicle if we can make that possible. And what will stay in the vehicle? Now, if you look at the present state of printers, you will see that any printer, any mobile printer which has been produced to date, is far bigger than the radio, far bigger and far heavier. And even the paper which a printer has is too big for you to carry around with you, and it's rather difficult to see how you could compress the size of a roll of paper and still have it usable. So if the radio moves out of the vehicle, then a printer will probably still be in the vehicle, and the main usefulness of this will be that if there is another radio left in the vehicle at the time when the prime working radio has gone away with the man on his body, then the printer will still be standing by to take a message whilst the guy is away. And they are already, in many cases, where in police forces, for example, where the policeman takes a body radio away with him, the vehicle is turned into a repeater. And this looks as if it will be a definite increasing trend, using the vehicle with a couple of antennas on it, in many cases, spaced one on each end of the car. This seems to be more frequently repeated pattern than duplexers in the car, although quite a few repeater arrangements in cars now use quite a reasonably small duplexer for the purpose, so that when the person with the body radio on him is away from the car, he merely puts the car equipment into a repeater mode and gets all his messages retransmitted to him to the car on his relatively insensitive body radio. And of course the horn being on the vehicle is a useful thing to summon him and anybody else to the vehicle by sticking the thing on command when the radio in the vehicle comes on. Can we have the next slide, Ray? Now this is an old bee in my bonnet, as people who know me will recognize. I've been on about it for years. I don't get very far, and I'm beginning to wonder myself whether I'm right, but until I've proven wrong, I've got to keep on. I am still disturbed about the fact that many people putting in systems, radio telephone systems, aim for the maximum area of coverage. I think you will agree that the telephone companies have realized the error of this and are concentrating on trying to get more cells, more small areas of operation, operating on the same frequency by taking the antennas down from mountaintops, reducing the coverage, reducing the power, and having more of them to cover more subscribers at a given time on a given frequency. And there is a major study underway at the moment in CCIR, which was precipitated by Germany, and the title of the study is a long title, something like this: how do you determine the optimum area for the coverage of a base station? And so far, one cardinal principle has arisen out of this, that what you should aim for is to cover a given number of radio people, not a given number of square miles. In other words, the size of coverage in geographical area of a base station should be the inverse of the population density. Now this makes good sense, but it's something which nobody seems to have written down before. The denser the city, the smaller the area of each base station to serve a group of subscribers or a group of people. Now this goes for private systems too, because all over the world there is a frequency shortage and you have to share between one system and another. And there is absolutely no point in having a 20 miles radius from a base station if all the vehicles to be served by the base station are within a 2 miles or 3 miles radius of that base station. It just deprives someone else 5 or 10 miles away of the same frequency which they could otherwise have used in perfect comfort. And the matching thing to this is the sensitivity of the receiver. Manufacturers usually advertise their receiver very proudly as being capable of 0.25 of a microvolt or 0.3 of a microvolt and insist that it's a good thing. And if a salesman keeps on saying it's a good thing, then the customer thinks it's a good thing. He doesn't question whether it's a good thing or not. But maximum sensitivity is not necessarily efficient sensitivity. The same thing applies as I was talking of with the transmitter. If you have 1,000 microvolts from your base station all the time, as you might have in Vancouver, for example, we have a station on British property which puts 1,000 microvolts across to the downtown area. And if you're working all the time in the downtown area with 1,000 microvolts of signal, and when you go in through the canyons of the city, this sometimes becomes depressed 14 dB, it's still hundreds of microvolts. What the hell is the point of having a 0.3 sensitivity receiver if you've got a 10 or 100 or 1,000 microvolts of signal? All that happens is that when your signal is not there, you hear something coming in by skip from Seattle, and it gets on your nerves. So there's no point. The same thing applies in inside plant operations. If you have a couple of things in the plant working to an overhead crane or something, you can often take off the antenna from the transmitter and the receiver and still communicate. But if you have the antenna on there and your 0.3 of a microvolt receiver, then you hear some interference from somebody else working in another plant, and it just doesn't make sense. So it seems to me that the manufacturer should build into a receiver a preset hot position where the technician can set it not just for somewhere between 0.5 and 1 microvolt, but for 5, 10, 15, or 25 microvolts, so that you can program the receiver for the particular conditions of the circuit. And I think that unless this is done, then there will be a greater tendency for users to put a pad in the receiver between the antenna and the coaxial relay, just in order to be able to get rid of the crap which comes in when he doesn't want it. Nobody said anything yet. Anybody want to say anything? When I put forward this first statement that one ought to cut down the area and cut down the power and cut down the elevation, etc., it was a meeting in New York. And Ken Norton, who's much more famous than I am, was in the audience, and he immediately came up with an exactly contrary argument. He said, everybody should put up their power 20 dB, and everybody should degrade their receivers 20 dB, because what we have to fight is not each other, it's man-made noise. And therefore, if everybody put a 20 dB pad in the receiver, then the man-made noise would disappear. But to compensate for it, everyone would have to bang out more power from the transmitters. So, of course, the only thing I could think of at the time was to accuse Ken of working for a transmitter manufacturer. But he has a point, of course. This would work. This would work. It would not worsen anything at all, except that the salesman would mention to the customer that, of course, if he happened to take out the 20 dB pad, his receiver would be back to 0.25 of a microvolt. And that is just what the customer would do. Whether, you know, it doesn't matter what you do to organize a system properly, If the customer or his own technician can foul it up, he will. That's one of Edsel Murphy's laws. Now, the splinter spacing has been on the verge, and as you know, yes, George?
Go back to the optimum area consideration for a moment.
Sure.
I was talking to Jack Holbert here, who tells me that he's trying to get another frequency, and everyone he looks at, some American, is using it. Is it not possible to get some sort of agreement between, say, the SEC and the DOC that maybe they should use directional antennas or have some sort of pattern to the antennas, the way the broadcast people shape their signals in the area served, so that we don't get interference from Rochester and vice versa?
Well, as a matter of fact, for the first time in history, it looks as if this might be done. As you know, in the United States, until about 2 years ago, if you applied for a business radio license, you asked for the number of watts ERP you wanted and the power you wanted, and you got it, wherever you were. They just gave up hope, and they didn't try to engineer assignments the way the DOC does. The DOC comes back and says, you don't really need that many watts to do what you want to do. You've got to bring it down to 20 or 30 or 50 or 75. The FCC just gave up hope and couldn't do that. But now the FCC are decentralizing their spectrum against opposition, I might add. You know, there's political opposition to it. It's just arisen in the last 2 or 3 weeks about the whole idea of decentralizing their spectrum occupancy program. But Chicago ran a program on that, as you know, and Stanford University came up with a research report which recommended that they should look at the usage of the spectrum and not merely the theoretical licensing occupancy of the spectrum. And the United States assure the Canadian government that they do intend to exercise some engineering control over the parameters granted to licensees. Now, I haven't heard any mention of the fact that they might include antenna patterns into that. But it makes sense that they would, because, you know, the rules of the DOC, although many people were opposed to them at the time when Part 2 of RSP 101 came out, enforcing a 10 dB antenna, was it 10 or 9? 9 dB, I think it was 9 dB antenna, and forcing you to find somewhere or other a transmitter which was of about 700 milliwatts. So that you could get the ERP that they said you could have with the high-gain antenna they said you had to have. It seemed kind of tedious and unnecessary at the time, but it was really a very good idea. And I think that there is good hope that the United States will do that for their own purpose, so that they can fit in more business radio frequencies in the state of New York and in Illinois. And this will naturally have advantage to us as well. I think it's too much to hope that they would do it because it has advantage to us. But it is a fact that when it comes to an argument between the United States and ourselves, they are well aware of the fact that they are very big and very powerful, and they're very sensitive about it, and they don't want to be publicly accused of being a big bully. So they often bend over backwards to do something that we want them to do, simply because they would feel guilty if they did what they have the power to do. And I notice they do this in international conferences all the time. They often back off on something that they could have put through just because everyone would say it was just the great, powerful United States has done it again and they've run roughshod over us. So I think we might get somewhere on that, you know, George. Anybody else? Go ahead.
Is there a possibility of frequencies being shared in radio on a timing basis?
Well, it's pretty difficult to it's pretty difficult to do that with different users, eh?
Some central computer controls. Is there a possibility of that?
I don't think there's much possibility in the near future of doing that, you know. It's already done to a small extent on a broad gauge basis. That is to say, when the DOC allocates a frequency, they do take into account the fact that one user on that frequency has different hours of optimum user usage to another user, so that they tend to try to timeshare over the 24-hour period. You know, they would like to put a company that starts work at 5 o'clock in the afternoon on the same frequency as another company which works from 8 o'clock till 5. But you're talking of specific, very short-term time sharing in the intervals of speech, etc., aren't you? Now, I don't see much possibility of that being done in the near future, and the main reason is this. There seems to be some definite opposition to the idea of professionally managed frequencies or groups of frequencies. You know, if you look at the thing from a purely technical point of view, the ideal would be for people not to have their own so-called private frequency at all. The ideal would be for people to contract with some kind of restricted common carrier who would manage a group of 10 frequencies or 6 frequencies in a block, all adjacent to each other. Or you could even go a little further if you're prepared to put up with a possible bureaucratic problem and say that one RCC ought to be appointed for the whole city as the frequency manager for that city. Then you could do that kind of thing, because then you could not only see that all the customers of that RCC were provided with 10 frequency sets and automatic selection of channels for, in effect, time sharing on the block. Your set selects a channel which is free and you make your transmission immediately instead of waiting for another user, just like in the telephone system you do with an IMTS kind of concept with idle marked channel. And you could develop a different kind of system for different kinds of users, because users like the police, for example, couldn't use a channel like IMTS where a transmission only takes 3 seconds. You don't want a trunking system where it takes you 3 seconds to get there for a 3-second message. And if you want to take a frequency, put it aside and say, for the purpose of this chase, everybody's on that frequency, all talking to each other, and the frequency's preempted for that operation. That sort of thing would be very difficult to do on a shared kind of system. But there are many things in private systems that could be done better with a frequency manager. Then you could have some kind of time sharing, because the fact is there is more space than mark in speech. There are more holes in speech than there are occupied slots. But the technology of it is expensive, and therefore it can't really be done on a one-by-one basis. Yeah?
If your thesis on R&D, you previously put forward, is correct, then this frequency management system will come in first in the military, where there's been considerable R&D since about 63, particularly in the U.S. And in that connection, it's interesting that there are two separate views on Ken Norton's proposition of higher power. That's the general U.S. military view, I believe. However, the British and in many European countries, they're lately they should go down in power and try and control man-made noise, because going up in power is increasing the man-made noise.
Yes, that's absolutely true. All those propositions are absolutely true. In Germany, you have a practical limitation of 6 watts right now on land mobile. It's almost impossible to get a license for more than 6 watts for the vehicle. Personally, I prefer that approach. I prefer the low-powered approach and the control of man-made noise approach. And there is something coming out, it's out now, I believe. It's either just come out or just about to come out on the control of man-made noise in Canada, on a further regulation over the transmission of man-made noise from electrical devices. And it's well overdue. As a ham, I welcome this, because TVI to me means the way the receiver just about destroys the 80 meter band. The television receiver radiates little blips of 15 kcs all over the 80 meter band for me. I don't have much problem getting into the other guy, but I sure have a lot of guys that get into me. And if we can get rid of things like that, it not only improves the other parts of the spectrum, but improves that part of the spectrum too. Because in the ad hoc 47960 committee in CRTPB, one of the problems that we have in trying to wrest some land mobile frequencies out of the TV people is finding a way to get rid of the taboos which would enable them to put all the cities that need UHF TV into channels 21 to 69 instead of 14 to 73. And oscillator re-radiation from TV receivers is one of the things which is very, very difficult to control with present tuner technique. But surely it's essential for the health of the TV community that that sort of thing should be controlled. Can I go on? Yep. The business of splinter spacing, it seems to me that you cannot accommodate 12.5 in the case of the increments which started at 100 and 15 kcs, kilohertz in the case of the increments that started at 120 with present day techniques. Trying to get the nose of the IF bandpass of the receiver wide enough to accommodate FM modulation, which is to all intents and purposes the standard on this continent, and at the same time get the bottom of the skirt narrow enough for adjacent channel selectivity, is almost an impossible task unless you put a 10 to the minus 8th oscillator into the thing, which most people don't want to pay for. The new spec 119, which is out for comment right now, nobody has phoned me yet to raise the roof, but I notice on looking at it that the tolerance is chopped in half for just about everything. We'll have a tolerance of 870 kilohertz on the 870 hertz on the 150 band, and 1750 on the 450 band. You know, everything is about half of what it was before, but it still wouldn't be possible to get down to 12.5 instead of 25 on 450 without about a 5 times more accurate oscillator in both the transmitter and the receiver to be able to keep the things within the nose bandwidth of the receiver. And besides that, we lose the advantage of the FM effect. When you get down to 12.5 kilohertz spacing, you get down to 3 or 4 kilohertz of deviation, and you've run into the position where you're no better off than you would have been on AM. And I think it's true to say, looking back, that Mr. What was his name? The chap that used to be the managing director of PI. He's now with STC. His name's dropped out of my head. He's been making speeches for years saying that you shouldn't be on FM at all, you should be on AM. And really, after about 15 years of speeches, he's almost becoming right. If we were on AM single sideband, then we could probably be down to 6 1/4 kilohertz spacing as they are in England on the AM VHF networks. But I haven't seen anything which, except a couple of academic papers, which predicate the possibility of single sideband FM. There have been a couple of papers in proceedings which have discussed the proceedings of IEEE, which have discussed the possibility of single sideband FM. But if we could have single sideband FM, then we might get somewhere with close spacing. And it's a really a more practical thing then than single sideband suppressed carrier AM, because that needs extremely precise oscillator control, which is extremely difficult to achieve at VHF range. Next slide, Ray.
Bob, maybe we should get Larson E. Rapp to do some more R&D on micro FM.
Yeah, unfortunately he died.
Did he?
Yeah. He died about 3 or 4 years ago.
What about transmitter noise? It seems to me that this is a very serious problem. I mean, you never mentioned, would you like to mention something about that? That's even given out problems on the present VHF band at 30 kilohertz spacing.
Yes, that's true, and it also, this is something which manufacturers don't talk very much about, and I don't blame them. transmitter noise is much worse with solid-state transmitters than it is with tube transmitters. So that, in a way, we've taken a step backwards in system concepts or system possibilities in favor of much better reliability. You know, there are several things which it's much more difficult to achieve with solid state than with tubes. And, you know, for example, the spec on low-frequency beacons, the Committee on Single Sideband Planning is being reactivated in the CRTPB right now. And their specific task is to see whether we have to degrade the present spec to accommodate the known capabilities of solid-state finals, or whether we will have two sets of specs, one with degraded intermod figures for solid-state finals and one with the present intermod figures for tube finals. And the transmitter noise thing, although that hasn't entered into this particular argument, at VHF the transmitter noise thing is the same thing. We might have to consider whether, because of the better reliability that you can get from solid-state equipment, we will allow the installation of solid-state equipment in certain cases where transmitter noise wouldn't do any harm. And for other cases, we would still have to insist on tube equipment because of the higher Q of the final. And these are quite serious problems, really, because philosophically, there's a tendency to say, if you can't make a better transmitter with solid state, then we shouldn't allow people to make solid state transmitters yet. So I think this is another area in which perhaps some of the predictions have gone, have taken a slower, they haven't exactly gone backwards, they've taken a slower step forward at the moment, that there are many things that we thought transistors would be the complete answer to, and they are not. And you take a look in the used pages of QST right now, I saw in the current issue someone's advertising a used KWM2 Collins tube rig for $1,195. And I asked somebody about this, I said, that's strange, I was offered one several years ago for $700 in Canada when I was looking for a new sideband rig, and he said, yeah, but there's a sort of a reversion to tube techniques on the part of some people who find that they'd better latch on to one of the higher quality tube rigs before it's too late, or they'll be all gone, because they're having some problems with the solid state rigs. So I think this is something which we have to think about, really, that solid state is not quite all it was originally cracked up to be. Although, of course, everyone agrees that it usually will run forever and not cause any problems. How do we stand for time?
20 minutes more.
20 minutes more. So,
Bob, before you go on to what you have on the screen here, I think you really should go back and consider that use of narrower or at least closer channel spacing. We, in very few sentences, more or less accepted the fact that we're wasting spectrum space by using the channel spacings we're using today. Yet, was there not a pretty comprehensive compilation of articles on modulation in this particular service by Busing, which was printed in the proceedings of the Vehicular Technology Group of about a year or so ago, that said that the 20 kilohertz channel spacing for this service is about right, based on the fact that you have sensitive receivers running in and out among very high power transmitters?
Yes, now, this is true.
If you don't agree with that, then I wish you would write something to refute it, but I have yet not seen anything to refute this article.
Well, really, I don't disagree with that. You see, 20 is perhaps, it's not, well, perhaps as Busing calls it, you could call it the optimum. But 20 is very difficult to change to. You see, if you at present on the LAN mobile band have 30, it is quite difficult to change to 20. You could change to 15 with absolutely no problem, but 15 is too narrow. 20 is in use on the low band, and it works. And I think 20 could possibly be made to work on the high band. But the administrative problems and the crystal cost of changing the whole spectrum from 30 spacing to 20 spacing is quite high. Now, it can be done, I think. It can be done in stages. As a matter of fact, I am, in a way, a sort of proponent of 20. In the telecommission, which occurred 2 years ago now, something like that, I put in a paper to the telecommission which said, in effect, here is a way that we might be able to convert to 20 in about three stages. You know, by because if you take the progression of 30, then when you've got two 30s, you've got 60, which equals three 20s. And by taking these common denominators of 20 and 30, there are certain channels that you can put aside for 20 on a progressive basis and end up in the end with half as many channels again as you had before. And I think possibly this could work. But you'll agree that the difficulty of changing from a present environment of 30 to a new environment of 20 is quite difficult.
I recognize that. It's just that I thought I should make a statement that said, be careful about 1 to 12.5 or whatever.
Yes, I agree with you. I agree with you that 20 is probably feasible on 150. I don't know about 450. You know, 450, it's dicey. It's actually, look, let's be honest, the present 25 spacing at 450 is not really efficient. You know, our present spec says that your receiver can be off 2350 hertz and your transmitter can be off 2350 hertz and still meet the spec 105. And that's too far, isn't it, for the nose bandwidth of 9 or 10 kilohertz, which you have on a receiver designed for 25 kilohertz spacing. You have to make more frequent frequency checks for netting the system than is technically desirable to keep the system in net at 450. So if we can't really, at the moment, produce equipment at a reasonable cost, which will meet the present spacing of 30, then can we talk about a spacing of 20? Or 15, or anything less than 30. It's a very difficult problem to reconcile the need for close spacing with the cost of very stable oscillators, especially when people don't want to use up battery to heat up the crystal, when they want to be able to run a module, a solid state module, thermistor controlled.
Well, you said that in England they're down to 6KC using ANC in the sideband. How high?
On the 100 megahertz band, well, what is it, 80, 88? They have a different band to us on VHF, and it's a bit lower than ours, but it includes about 80 megahertz and goes up into 100 and something megahertz.
If they've managed to get this kind of spacing,
well, the historical trend was 180 degrees out of phase. Britain went for AM. They have very little FM in use in Britain on the VHF band. We have practically no AM in use on the VHF band except in ham operation. And the British were saying many years ago that America made a mistake in going to FM. At the time, they didn't make a mistake, because the FM with 15 kilohertz deviation was incomparably superior to any kind of AM you could possibly produce, you'll agree. And even narrowband FM with plus or minus 5 deviation is still a lot better than you can do with AM. But that's as far as you can go. So that 10, 15, and 20 years ago, the United States and Canada were right in going for FM. Today, we've reached the end of the road as far as improvement of the FM system is concerned, and I think we're in trouble. Whereas Britain has managed to chop and chop and chop again. But they suffered a lot of relatively poor communications in the 25 years up to now. When I was in the Air Force, I had a special K unit produced by Fred Link, an FM unit with 250 watts in the final, and it was absolutely marvelous. We only had four units like it in the Royal Air Force, and we were in constant demand everywhere. Any commander wanted us to connect his rear and base headquarters together, because all the other FM unit, all the other VHF units were using modified aircraft equipment in the 144 region, which was AM, and the difference in communication between the two was so ridiculous. Ours, you could connect it onto the local PBX and you'd hardly know you were going over radio. But you sure couldn't mistake the fact you were going over radio if you went on to what we called an H unit, which had 10 watts in a rhombic, instead of our 50 watts or 250 watts of FM with a rhombic. But I think that now we reach the crunch because of crowding, where AM becomes a possibility again. Although, as you recognize, single sideband at VHF is no snip either, when 100 or 200 hertz of frequency shift causes problems. So, now, I'd better cover the thing at the bottom first. The Rostov report is the what it says at the bottom is Rostov report telephoned by radio. Put that up at the top, if you will, Ray. The Rostov report is the common designation for a report which was commissioned by President Johnson. It wasn't finished before he was turfed out, and it was presented to President Nixon, and it was actually called the President's Task Force on Communications Policy, but it was edited or headed by Eugene Rostov, so it's usually called the Rostov Report. And in the Rostov Report, there's a number of staff papers from government people, and one of them is F.R. Eldridge, who's no relation of mine, but I respect him very highly, despite his name. He wrote a paper there which said that the future telephone system locally will work by radio. He says that the person with a telephone number, which will be analogous to some other number, you know, in the United States probably his Social Security number or something will be his personal telephone number. He will have his telephone in his pocket, and the telephone will be a small two-way radio. And as he walks along a block in the city, the radio will belt out every so often a binary identification of him. If it's Bob Eldridge walking along the street, his radio sends out a very short bleep of digits, binary digits, which say in effect, this is Bob Eldridge. Now, the transmitter receiver in that block is looking for anybody who is walking along that block, and it hears the identification of anybody in the block come in. It transmits it back to the computer controlling the telephone system, and the computer stores in its temporary memory the fact that Bob Eldridge is walking along that block on Georgia Street in Vancouver. If somebody calls Bob Eldridge's number, it goes to the computer, and the computer looks in the bank and says, Bob Eldridge is walking along that block in Georgia Street. It accesses the transmitter and zips out a selective address for his telephone. It beeps in his pocket, he takes it out, and he talks. Now, when he gets back to the office, he sits down with that thing still in his pocket, and he doesn't have a telephone on his desk because he doesn't need it. The telephone is in his pocket. Now, all the wire plant, which at the moment is used to connect to all those telephones on the end of wires, will be used to connect the transmitter receivers and mini computers and maxi computers together to run the system. Now, I very much think he might be right. You know, the trend lately has been to say, cannot we take things off radio and put them on wire because we have to conserve the spectrum? But new techniques of using higher frequencies and small cell techniques with automatic handover from cell to cell will make it possible to use the spectrum more efficiently and the radio spectrum becomes usable again. A man that I deeply loved and respected until he died a couple of years ago, Bert Tupper, made a very wise observation during the course of the discussions on the telecommission. We were talking about the radio spectrum having been used up, and he said, in the course of my radio career, we've exhausted the radio spectrum about three times. And I think he's right. You appear to have exhausted it, you get down to the problem, and you find a new way to find great big holes in it, and you use it again. And the Rostov, or the F.R. Eldridge concept of the radio telephone, or the telephone used by radio, is wholly dependent on a very high frequency. By very high, I'm talking in generic terms, I mean really something like perhaps 2 gigahertz, or possibly 1, and very small cells, and controlled handover from cell to cell. Very much the thing that is all the vogue at the moment in papers on spectrum utilization. Mr. Starris of RCA seems to be leading the pack at the moment with drawing pretty little hexagons. You noticed how spectrum planners always draw hexagons? They fit together much nicer than circles, and you don't have spaces in between. It reminds me of the idea, you know, the ideal radio antenna for VHF service area offering is one which throws a slider. It throws the signal out like that, and then it dips, because then it covers the fringe of the area, but it doesn't get into the next area. Over. Could we have a look at the next? I've only got about 5 minutes, haven't I?
About 10 minutes.
8 minutes. Forget that one for now. I want to talk about HF. No. That's the one. There seems to be a resurgence of HF radio. We thought that as we go to VHF, that HF would be outdated and would gradually fall into decay. But the HF radio assignments are still increasing at about 10% per year, the applications for new licenses, for new frequencies in the HF spectrum. And there's a very active body of HF proponents in the communication research laboratories of the Canadian government at Shirley Bay. And they have pointed out that if we were prepared to spend as much money on the development of HF radio as we are now spending on satellites to serve the North, we could probably serve the North as efficiently by HF radio as we can by satellite, with communications as good, despite the vagaries of the ionosphere. If you're allowed to use enough power and you can choose your frequencies accurately enough and you can swap them about frequently enough, you can give very, very good service by HF, but it costs money. But it doesn't cost any more millions of dollars than putting Anik up there to serve the Eskimos does.
I think it would.
You think it would? You think it would cost even more?
Yes.
Well, we in BCTEL have recently, in the last 5 years or so, we've improved our HF system by a tremendous amount, just by the expedient of getting somebody to look after it instead of me. and he has one of the things which he's done is computerize the entire selection of channels for customers and of frequencies for use in different times of the day. Our subscribers are now dished out with charts which tell them which channel to use at which time of the day, and a new subscriber wanting to come onto the system, the computer looks at his geographical coordinates and says, if he has 3 channels, it ought to be this one, this one, and this one. If he has 4 channels, it ought to be this one, this one, this one, and this one, and so on. And now, Tony, the fellow that succeeded me, is going into the business of automatic channel indication, so that a subscriber can look at the channels and see which one is actually working at the moment, even if there's not traffic on it.
Yes, but if you went into
using HF for worldwide communications the way satellites are, you would not only have to choose your own channels locally, but everybody in the world would have to choose the proper channel at the right time. You would have to have
True.
Some kind of a network to inform the people which channel to switch to at which time, so they'd probably put up a satellite to tell them.
True. Yes, I agree. On a worldwide basis, it would be an administrative nightmare that IFRB wouldn't try to start tackling. But thinking in terms of other people having deserted the HF radio spectrum and us being left with a bit more use of it than we had before, I think that, mind you, I am saying that CRC say that they could serve the North as well as a satellite. I don't believe it either. But it is a fact that we can do a hell of a lot better on HF radio with our present techniques than we ever did before.
Yes, but I had an HF radio system on a job I was on. We had no trouble going 300 miles from one station. And by careful selection of our channel, we had no problem in reaching our vehicles and our station. But we sometimes had arguments with a passing fishing fleet.
Yes.
If he's got good communications on that channel, and he's planning planning to go into harbor that night in the dark or something like that, he's not going to give it up.
Yes. Yes, I agree. There aren't so many channels in the HF spectrum as there are in the satellite spectrum. That's the whole problem. When you get up into the frequencies that we speak of in satellites, you've got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of channels all nicely spaced away from each other, but in the HF radio spectrum we've only got really dozens of channels to deal with, so the interference problem is immense. But down near the bottom there's Lincompex, which in Europe at the moment is a magic word, and Canada has a few in use trying, and AT&T are trying a few. And this is a very interesting concept of a linked compressor and expander. The normal compander operation is a fixed affair. You compress it and then you expand it. The Lincompex, it meters on an FM subcarrier as part of the HF transmission what has happened at the compressor. And this metering, telemetering, is then applied to the expander at the far end, and it expands it by the same amount that it was compressed. Now the useful thing about this is that it keeps a constant circuit loss, so it doesn't lift it up by its own bootstraps and burst out into ringing, which is normal with a lot of compression at the sending end. So what happens is that the full dynamic of the speech which went into the original compressor is created at the output of the far end expander. There are two versions of it, one for fixed systems, HF point-to-point systems, and another one for mobile systems. And the maritime mobile one has the disadvantage that it has to work in down in about 2700 hertz for the voice band. And now Germany, that probably has equivalent to Lincompex in the R&D work somewhere, says that German can't be talked if you're confined to 2700. So there's a study going on to see whether you really can get K's and P's and T's and S's and things through a 2700 hertz voice channel.
Isn't a lot of the syllabic information in Lincompex put in a separate channel, the narrow bands?
No. All the actual intelligence is within the band 270 to 2700. It's only the compression and expansion command which is on the separate channel. Up about 300 hertz above the top voice frequency is this little FM subcarrier, which is merely telemetering the expansion and compression information.
Well, without that, everybody sounds more or less the same.
Yes, well, actually, most HF transmitter receivers have a CCIR bandpass of 2700 hertz anyway, you know, whether Lincompex is on it or not. It so happens that when you put Lincompex on, you have to chop off another couple of hundred hertz off the top to be able to accommodate the subcarrier at the top end of what was originally the speech bandpass. There was, I just noticed this week, a note that there's a very pretty Eskimo girl on a photograph in Bell Labs somewhere who was talking up to Anik and back again to a room which was adjacent to see that the Eskimo language really can be transmitted over the satellite circuit. And it seems to me that the Eskimo language, which is full of K's, is very much analogous to German and Russian in its syllabic content. And perhaps we do have to pay some attention to bandpass for those languages, but they've been getting along for years on the same restricted bandpass. Every German ham uses a filter in his sideband equipment which is about 2200 hertz across the top and seems to be able to talk, and we seem to be able to understand him even though he talks a crazy language.
Also, in regard to your comments that the DLC made, I think one has to keep in mind that a lot of the experience of the people there has been in HF and in sounding, and this could account for sort of a built-in bias towards HF.
True. And HF in the past was sometimes pretty bloody, so the built-in bias really, I suppose, is justified. I think I've really just about used up my time, haven't I, Ray?
Yeah, just about.
I better sit down, eh?
I think we'll cut it off.
The program has been arranged. At the end, we will have an hour in which we can come back and ask further questions of the speakers that we didn't have time for. We will now break off for coffee, and we'll get back here, if we can, about 10:45.